The British politician and writer Lord Acton is the one who famously said, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." Now, in Jesus' day, the power brokers of his society were twofold. On the political end of the spectrum, you had the Caesar, and you had his tetrarchs like Herod, and you had governors like Pontius Pilate that we'll be introduced to in the story of Jesus very soon. You had the military might and the taxation of an empire of Rome that ultimately was the power, that ultimately was the authority to do what they wanted to do. But at the same time, religiously and culturally in the area where Jesus lived and ministered, religiously and culturally, the power brokers of the society were this group known as the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders, primarily made up of Pharisees, scribes, lawyers. And what's interesting is as you read the Gospels, or as you read even secular history sources of Greek historians, Roman historians, Jewish historians like Josephus, they would all describe these two power brokers of society as being incredibly corrupt. That in both word and deed, they were using their power to manipulate and to control other people, and often for their harm. And you often see throughout Jesus' ministry that he cared nothing about ingratiating himself to either of those two groups. Now, he wasn't intentionally trying to offend them, or certainly not to disobey or not be subject to them in honorable ways, but he just didn't care about, what we would say is like kissing up to them. What's interesting also is that these two power brokers of Jesus' society, the Romans and the Sanhedrin, they hated each other. The Pharisees hated the fact that they, as the people of Israel, were subject to Gentiles. And those Gentiles hated the fact that they had, in a sense, given up this mountain in Jerusalem, in this city, in a part of their empire where it wasn't worship of the emperor that took place, it was worship of this god Yahweh. And they just kind of made space for each other, but they hated one another. But it was Aristotle who said, a common danger unites even the bitterest enemies. And in Jesus, the Romans and the Pharisees found that common danger. They found a threat to their power. And it's interesting, you can read this even in the Gospels, the Romans perceived Jesus as this wandering prophet, this Jewish prophet, who's what's he doing? He's healing the blind. He's raising the dead. He's giving people bread. And he's telling them to be subject to the authorities, and yet they said, this guy has to die. And the religious leaders, again, they perceive him not as the Messiah ultimately, but as this Jewish prophet, as this faith healer who has more power, who has more respect of the people than what even they do. And they say, therefore, he has to die. And you'll see here in a text like this that as Jesus has come up to Jerusalem for the last time, for this last Passover that he participates in, the Romans and the Herodians, the Jews, the religious leaders are going to begin to come together and say, we agree that Jesus is this common threat, and we're willing to do anything now to get rid of him. So Luke chapter 20, let's begin reading in verse 9. And he, that is Jesus, began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went away into another country for a long while. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant, but they also beat and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And so he sent a third. This one also they wounded and cast out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours. And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. And when they heard this, they said, surely not. But he looked directly at them and said, "What then is this that is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him." The scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them, but they feared the people. So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be sincere so that they might catch him in something that he said, so as to deliver him up to the authority and the jurisdiction of the governor. So they asked him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly and show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not?" But he perceived their craftiness and said to them, "Show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have?" And they said, "Caesar's." He said to them, "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were not able in the presence of the people to catch him in what he said, but marveling at his answer, they became silent. This is the word of the Lord. This text is all about power and control. You're going to see Jesus here using a parable and then an illustration of these guys that banded together against him. You're going to see the addiction to power and the abusive power, but you're also going to see Jesus come alongside these crowds and show them, here then is the remedy to our natural bent to abuse power. So let's begin with this parable, and you see in verse 9, the verse where we let off, he began to tell the people this parable, and he's talking to the people, and he's sharing a parable, and the point of the parable is to explain to the people, your leaders, your religious, spiritual leaders, have a bloodlust for power. So you look back at this parable, and if you don't understand, it's kind of allegorical. Jesus is weaving a story that I think as they begin to hear different pieces of this, they intuitively know exactly what and who Jesus is talking about. In the Old Testament, the vineyard was a picture of Israel, the people of God. And there were these different prophets that were sent into the vineyard to tend the vineyard, to keep the vineyard, to help the people of God continue to worship and to enjoy and to obey God. So you see that the tenants, as this translation says, the tenants are the spiritual leaders of Israel. God is obviously the master. He's the owner of this vineyard. But it's an interesting word that he uses here. The tenants is actually the kind of the Greek word for a sharecropper. If you don't know, a sharecropper is basically someone that they don't own the land, but they say, "We will come and work your land." You know, someone may be very wealthy and own property, but say, "I don't know farming." And so in a partnership, you come and you farm the land, and you get to make a tidy profit. And what I ask as the share of the crop is that you give me some of the fruit of the vineyard. And this was a very common arrangement then. And Jesus pictures these spiritual leaders as these sharecroppers who have this calling ultimately to bear fruit for God. Now the servants, as I said, who come from the master, these are the different Old Testament prophets who God sends to tell the sharecroppers, you're not doing what the master wants you to do. Just a reminder that you're supposed to be giving some of the fruit back to God. That ultimately the reason that you cultivate the people of God is that there's a fruit for God. And then this final character that's introduced in the parable is that as they run off prophet after prophet after prophet, the master God says, "Let me send my own beloved son." And I think very clearly that's obviously Jesus, the Son of God, who's sent to this vineyard to give the spiritual leaders a final warning that they could have actually turned from their sin and their abuse of the people of God, and they could have repented and they could have followed God's calling on their lives. And the first thing that we see in this parable, I'm calling the addiction to power. Because what you see is kind of the key to understanding this parable is that there comes a point near the very beginning of the story that Jesus tells that the tenants stopped viewing themselves as tenants. that initially, in a sense, they are leasing something that belongs to someone else. And they understand that that's the arrangement. We are leasing the master's field. We are producing a crop, and we give a portion back to the master as the payment of our lease. But very early on, as these servants come and say, give us some for the master, they say, no. And they stop seeing themselves as tenants under the control and the leadership of the master, and they start saying, we control what happens in this vineyard. We have power. We have authority over this vineyard, and we'll do what we want. We will not submit to some outside leader and what he wants. And so in the parable, the tenants stopped fulfilling their calling. They stopped paying rent. But you notice that as the prophets come in, the Old Testament prophets, and they're coming to these leaders of Israel and they're warning them and saying, God tells you as shepherds of the people to turn from fleecing the sheep and using them and manipulating them to make yourselves more powerful and wealthier at their expense. You're not loving them. You're not shepherding them. And so I call this an addiction to power, because you see that the tenants are saying, we have to shut down anyone who is questioning our dominion over our little tiny kingdom. And you see then that God sends his beloved son to give these tenants one more opportunity to turn from their sin and to repent. And you see here very clearly that the spiritual leaders of Israel actually loved their own power and control more than they loved their Messiah. And story after story, as we've seen as we go through the Gospel of Luke, it basically says they understand who he is. Like, they get the fact that all these Old Testament prophecies about only the Messiah will do these things. Only the Messiah will be like this. And the leaders of Israel that know these Old Testament scriptures can see, okay, Jesus is doing all of these things, but he's not the kind of Messiah we want. We're going to lose power to him. He needs to die. And interestingly enough, as you go here, look at verse 19, that Jesus finishes this parable. This is the reason I went on in the text. Says the scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour because they knew the parable was against them. And they're humiliated that Jesus has told this parable in front of the people, and they're so addicted to power, so addicted to the control that they had over people's lives. They're like, he just told that against us. You know, in our culture, they're looking at each other and like, no, he didn't. Yeah, he did. And you see this addiction of power spiral into what I then call the abuse of power. And I use this as a double meaning, that both, if you have an addiction to power and control, even over your own life, that addiction will lead you to take the power that you do have and to abuse it rather than to use it. But the double meaning is, if you make a god of power and control, do you know that power and control will actually abuse you as well? And I can show this to you. First of all, let me show you that the love of power makes you a phony. Verse 20, so they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be sincere so they might catch him in something he said. Like, don't you hate that when people pretend to be sincere? I mean, what we see here in verse 21 then, teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly and show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God. Well, if you knew that, then why don't you worship him? Why don't you follow what he's saying? Well, because it's just flattery. I love this. Somebody once described gossip as, gossip is saying behind someone's back what you would never say to their face. Flattery is saying to someone's face what you would never say behind their back. That's the truth. Like, you know I despise this person, and every time I talk behind their back, I'm venting about how horrible this person is, and I go to them and I'm like, oh, hey, bless Jesus, how are you doing today? Like, you are so wonderful. And people still do this today. Why? They're manipulating and they're using other people to maintain power and control over them. And that's what you see these Pharisees and scribes doing, is that they're pretending to be sincere. They're flattering. There's this hypocrisy. Why? Why are they so phony? It's because they know we've got to use Jesus right now to get what we want. See, secondly, that the love of power makes you a plotter. Do you ever catch yourself going behind someone's back and having lengthy conversations about this is what needs to happen to this person? Like maybe it's in the office setting, and like you all have the same view of this one coworker or this one boss. Or maybe it's at the gym and like everybody kind of like, ha-ha, this person, and you talk about how annoying this person is. Or maybe it's even in your family, or maybe it's even in your church. But you see here, verse 14, back to this parable, these sharecroppers go to one another and they're talking amongst themselves and they're plotting and they're planning. That this wasn't just a spontaneous thing that came upon them, what our culture may refer to as manslaughter. Like, oh, the opportunity presented itself when we killed this person. But there's an element of premeditation here. They said to themselves, this is the heir to the vineyard. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours. Now, there's an interesting tidbit that we can pull from other records of this time period, that it was actually Jewish law that if a sharecropper basically farmed the same plot of land for 3 years, and the owner of that vineyard or the owner of that crop kind of took off and was never around in 3 years' time, that the sharecroppers could basically stake their claim, this is now our property. You know, in our culture, I think we refer to that as adverse possession. Like, I just kind of moved in on your land and you didn't even know it because you were somewhere else, but after a certain number of years, it becomes mine. And they're looking at Jesus and they're plotting because they realize he's the king, he's the heir, the inheritance is his. But if the son is dead, and they're already presuming, you know, the reason that the master hasn't come and checked on us himself is because he's probably already passed away. So if we kill the son, it's ours. I want you to notice how, again, this abusive power, how power starts to do stuff to you, how power can make you an incredibly unprincipled person. Because at this point in the story, you notice it's all about expediency. You know, does the Jewish law ever condone murder? No. This is first degree premeditated murder of the Messiah. And you see how unprincipled and expedient the religious spiritual leaders of Israel have become, because their lust for power and control is so overriding and compelling in their hearts, they would be willing to do anything, including plotting the murder of Jesus. So the love of power makes you phony. It makes you a plotter. It also makes you, thirdly, it makes you a people pleaser. I want you to notice in verse 16, when Jesus comes to the end of this parable, do you notice what the religious leaders are freaking out over? I mean, it's hilarious, if it weren't so serious. He gets to the end of the parable and he says, okay, in the parable they understand the religious leaders are killing the Messiah. And they're like, still no problem. And he says, and the master, God, is going to take the vineyard away from you and give it to others. And they're like, surely not. Give it to others. Like who? You know, the Gentiles? Yes, exactly, the Gentiles. And their concern is not over their plots to kill the Messiah. Their concern is about losing their leadership. That's all they care about. Is we could lose our leadership. What do we need to do? What do we need to change to continue to please the people so we can stay in power? You notice verse 19, the scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived, we know the parable's against us, but they didn't. Why? Because they feared the people. Oh, irony of ironies. The very people that you want to dominate, that you want to control, that you want to manipulate, that you want to use for your personal gain, for your personal benefit, you're terrified of them because you knock them out of alignment because they all love Jesus. They all want to follow Jesus. You do something to rattle their cage, all of a sudden they turn on you, you lose your power. So again, it's this irony of I'm abusing you. I'm using my power to dominate and to control you and to lie to you and to deceive you and to hurt you. But you control me because I've got to do just enough to get you to kind of stay quiet, stay in line. And the love of power will always make you a people pleaser. Now, as we come to application of this, I don't think there's anybody in here who would like to admit, yes, you know, I have a lust for power. Thanks for bringing this up this morning. I have a bloodlust for control. But I want to ask you six questions. Number one, do you have an inflated sense of self-importance where you feel like your time, your money, your opinions, your preferences, your politics are more important than those of other people? Because that sense of self-importance is where the love of power and control comes from. These leaders of Israel were self-important. It's our ideas that matter, not God's ideas, not even the Word of God, not even the person, the present person of God is less important than our opinions of how things need to go. Secondly, do you ever find yourself being disingenuous with people because you're really just using them to get something you want? Flattery is disingenuous. Again, you're saying something to someone's face that you would never say behind their back. Wonderful message, Pastor. You know, you get in the car. That was terrible. That was so bad today. And I'm not saying that you do that to me. But do you do that with any relationship where you know you're being disingenuous, you know you're being insincere, because you need to manipulate that person or that group of people to get them to do something that you want? How often even Christians are double-tongued, where they're saying one thing that I know this group wants to hear, and I'm saying something different that I know this group wants to hear, and you're like, where's the truth in that? Well, I'm manipulating now two groups of people so that I have control over my circumstances and maybe even control over these people. Question three, do you tend to see people as other human beings made in the image of God worthy of respect? Or do you go through life and think, that person's a help, that person's a hindrance? That person is a stepping stone to what I want. That person is a stumbling block or an obstacle to what I want. Do you view people as people? Or do you make two pools of people? These people can help me get what I want. These people are a hindrance. Next question, do you derive pleasure from feeling like people respect you? And do you catch yourself manipulating others to get even more respect? Like, some of you may know, like if people knew the real me, you wouldn't respect me. And so you adjust the record and the facts of your life, maybe even a community group that you're willing to share, you're not being authentic. These are my struggles, these are my successes. But because you get a kind of a sick pleasure of like, people respect me, people think I'm really something, and you want to maintain that control, that power, that authority, you're dishonest. Next, do you feel uncomfortable in situations where you don't have control? Not like, I'm sad, I'm confused, I'm not sure what to do, I've lost control. But do you actually feel this like simmering frustration and anger of like, I've worked so hard and I'm not going to let this person wreck this? Because you feel like you've lost control over something. Because by the way, in our culture, there are lots of people and groups that are more powerful than you and I are. And so this is going to happen all the time. How do you react to that when someone does something and you just lost something you really wanted? Maybe something even that you thought God called you to pursue. Does it cause you to look to God in faith and say, I don't know what you're doing here, but I trust you? Or does it cause you to become angry because you've lost control? You've lost power that you had or that you thought you would have. Then finally, we'll just stick our toe in politics just a tiny bit. Do you vote for politicians and policies that give you a sense of empowerment? Or do you vote for politicians and policies that give empowerment away to other people. See, there's a very subtle thing that happens. It certainly happened in the last election. I know a number of Christians, and I don't mean specific individuals, but I mean this Christian right that voted for things that they're like, well, we're going to hold our nose because we know the Bible's against all of this, but we have to get in power. What are you doing? Like, are you looking to a God who is in power and saying, like, look, we trust you? Or are you compromising because you want power over other people, over other groups that you not just disagree with, but that you despise? Are you engaged, in other words, are you civilly engaged in how can I use my life, how can I use my vote to empower, to love, to serve other people? Or is it like just what's best for me? Now, I want to just stop and note that to the degree that we have a love or a lust for power and control, that's going to be at odds with our love for God. And that love, that lust will ultimately come not only to control us in an ironic way, but it will actually come to destroy us. It will ruin us. So let's go finally to Jesus' better way. And I call this simply an allegiance to the all-powerful. Let's work backwards through this text. You notice that the story of the poll tax, which many of you are familiar with these most famous words of Jesus, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, render to God the things that are God's. You notice there's a context to the story. And it's right on the heels of this parable where Jesus has offended, well, not just that, he's outraged the religious leaders. And they're like, we got to trick him. Somebody come up with a question. Oh, here's a good one. Now, so you have a little context. The poll tax, and we don't think of poll tax anymore, but a poll tax is simply your tax on you for merely existing. So thank you for existing within the Roman Empire this year. You owe the king a denarius, and you and you and you and you, and no matter whether you're a man, a woman, a child, a newborn, elderly, everyone owes that same poll tax. Thank you for existing within someone else's empire. And so nothing outraged the Jews, like the good Orthodox Jews, like the poll tax. You're telling me for merely existing and living on the land that God promised to give us, we have to pay a foreign invader a denarius with the image of Tiberius Caesar and the words that say, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. I mean, they literally said, I'm the king, the son of God. And on the back, it said, high priest. Incredibly offensive to the Jewish people. So they come up with this question, like, oh, is it lawful? Is it the right thing to do to pay the poll tax or not? And you can see how they're thinking. If Jesus says it is not lawful, do not pay the poll tax, well, they're going to run right off to Herod and the governor and say, you got a problem on your hands because the Messiah, the king who just came to his city, is saying don't pay the poll tax. And Herod would be like, yeah, we got a problem, and Herods don't have problems chopping people's heads off, John the Baptist. So that's what would happen to Jesus. He'd be done with. At the same time, if Jesus says, yes, pay the poll tax, well, there are these crowds of people that are loyal Jews that they seethe at paying the poll tax, and they just hear this popular faith healer, prophet, say, pay the poll tax. And so either way, they're like, we win. And basically the question, again, is a question of loyalty and power. Is Jesus loyal to the Roman authorities, or is he loyal to our authorities? And Jesus, with his brilliant answer, says, I'm loyal to God, as you should be. He says, look at this coin, okay? And there's an irony here, too, that Jesus doesn't have the coin on him, but the enemies who tried to trick him with the question, he's like, here, let me see the coin. And one of them's like, oh, okay, well, I got the coin. Whose image is this? Whose inscription is this? Well, it's Caesar's. Well, then, and basically the spirit of which he says it, like, then give it back to him. It's fine. It's his. Who cares? But what is God's image and inscription on? You know, if you are made and redeemed in the image of God, and he stamped his name on you and your name on him, then he's saying your entire life belongs to God. And he's saying if your ultimate allegiance belongs to God, guys, you're free. You are free to give proper allegiances to other authorities in your life and give them what they're due, no more, no less, but to give them what they're due because you're free. See, when we have a lust for power and control over our own lives, we pick and choose what earthly powers we're willing to render taxes, allegiance, loyalty, prayers. I mean, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but like some of you, you did not pray for a Democratic president, even though the Bible says pray for those who have authority over you. You're like, I'm not praying for that. And some of you right now, like, dude, this buffoon that's in office, I ain't praying for that. You're not willing to render because you feel like I've lost control. I've lost what I want because these certain people are in power. Well, if your ultimate allegiance is to God and you're like, God, you are in power. I don't know why you let some of this stuff happen down here, but you are in power and my ultimate allegiance is to you. That suddenly frees you to say, Lord, you called me to render to this person, this authority, my boss at work, my parent. You know, if you're still living at home, you called me to render certain things to them that I'm willing to give because my ultimate trust, my ultimate loyalty is to God. I'm free. But I want to go on just a step further in this allegiance to the all-powerful that Jesus calls us to, because I want you to see that he refers to himself as the all-powerful, but I want you to see what he does with his power. So you go back to the parable, and again, who is Jesus in the parable of the vineyard? He's not a servant. He's not a tenant that's leasing alongside other spiritual leaders. He's not one of many. The Bible says, Jesus says, I'm the beloved son. I am the heir to all of this. This all belongs to me. Okay, so he has power. He has control. He has authority. We could use all of those words. He actually is important. He actually is significant. How did he use his significance? How did he use his importance? How did he use his power, his control, his authority? He goes to the vineyard knowing he's going to get killed. See, can you trust someone who takes the ultimate power that belongs only and rightfully to him and says, I'll give that power away to redeem my enemies, to rescue my enemies, to love my enemies so that they can be free from the lust of power and control, so that they can be truly free? See, the rightful heir to everything laid aside his inheritance, goes to a cross, dies, betrayed, so that he can share his inheritance with the very people who were trying to steal it before. We are glory thieves. We are all glory thieves. We do things and we want the credit. We want the power. We want the control. And Jesus is like, yeah, I came and I laid aside that power to die for glory thieves so that I can share glory with you, so I can share the inheritance with you forever. And notice you can reject him, verse 17. You can say, no, he's not my heir. He's not my God. I'm not going to build my life on him. He says, you can reject this stone. It doesn't matter. He is the cornerstone. He's citing this verse from the Old Testament. You can be sifting through your pile of stuff and be like, nope, don't want to build with that. We're going to build with this stuff. And he's like, okay, so you're going to build this thing that's now lopsided and off, because the picture of the cornerstone is it's the first stone that you need to lay, and a lot of work went into that cornerstone of an ancient temple or building to get all of the angles to be perfectly right angles, so that as you build on top of that and you go higher and higher, it stays plumb, it stays square. You know, there's a building in San Francisco right now, I think it's called the Millennium Tower, that is sinking. The foundation is sinking ever so slightly. And you go up 800 feet, I think it is, and guess how far that top of that building is out of alignment because the foundation is sinking just slightly. And Jesus is like, you can reject me, but I am the cornerstone. And if you build your life on me, part of what he's saying, if you build your life on me and you let me set the angles and you let me set the trajectories, then this life that you build on the foundation of Jesus Christ is reliable, is sure, it's plumb with what God's expectations are of you are. You know, I was reading these stories and I see Jesus as the heir to the vineyard. I see him as the cornerstone. I see him as the one in whose image we are made. And I think of this other favorite verse that Paul talks about how everything is from Jesus, it's through Jesus, and it's ultimately to or for Jesus. And if we live out of that truth that every aspect of our lives is from him, through him, and for him or to him, we are free from the lust of power because we have allegiance to the one who has all power and who used that power only for our good. If you retold this story of the vineyard and put yourself in it, and I want you to do that. I'm inviting you to do that. You are a sharecropper. Did you know that? God has this vineyard. He's like, these are my people. This is my vineyard. And you are called to sharecroppers because you are not the owners of the vineyard, but I've called you to come and do this work with me and bear this fruit with me. So if we leave Jesus at the center and say, Lord, this is your people. This is your mission. And I get called into it, and I get this amazing privilege of working alongside Jesus Christ, God, to bear fruit, to give to you for your glory. And you see Jesus over and over and over again saying, yes, it's ultimately fruit for my glory, but it is your joy. It is this partnership. I could have done it without you, but I chose not to. I wanted you to do this with me. This is your mandate. This is your calling, but this is your privilege. That we get to be sharecroppers with Jesus, looking to Jesus, saying, this is for you. This is through you. This is to you. So we went to the Parade of Lights last night downtown. We joked, like, every year it's like 12 degrees, so we've never gone. And I'm not a parade person. I'm like, I can watch that on TV. Don't need to see stuff, like, in person. But we went with some friends downtown, and the kids were very excited. And we wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. And finally, you know, more and more people, like, we're standing up on this planter, so we have this high view to look down into the street. And more people are like, oh, excuse me, I'm just passing through. And then they lied and they tricked us and they were not passing through and they stood right in front of us, okay? So finally, after like an hour, this parade starts coming through, like weaving its way through downtown. And Marty picks up Miles, our two-year-old, and I pick up our four-year-old. And I have him sitting on my shoulders. And so I'm like right at the level of everybody else, and I'm like, this is just stupid. Like, I mean, if something's really tall, like a float going by, I see like this part of it, and it's just like magically moving through the air, you know. But he's up here, and so he's, you know, 2 feet higher than me, and he can see. And all of a sudden, there's this, I could see, like, between people, there's this Wells Fargo wagon, like the old wagon, I mean, you know, horse-drawn wagon, like going by in front of us, and these horses are like prancing along, and these people like riding on top, yay, and like everybody's waving, and it's Christmassy, and Mike is up here, and he's like, woo, jellyfish, jellyfish, woo, jellyfish, jelly, and I'm like, dude, those are horses. And I'm like looking, and I'm like, oh my word, we seriously need to leave right now and go do like some zoology stuff. Like, these are horses. And I even told him, I was like, Micah, those are horses. And he's like, woo, jellyfish, jellyfish. And I'm like, jellyfish have nothing to do with Christmas, you know, Kris Kringle, Jesus, Nativity. Like, whoever's doing this, they're not, you know. Well, like 2 minutes later, this one little sliver I can see, like, right between these two people, like, there were jellyfish. I mean, these people like had these big things on poles and there's jellyfish dancing in the street. And my point of all this is that when you're in a huge crowd of people, a two-year-old and a four-year-old are basically powerless. They have no control. They have no advantage. They have no privilege. and someone who was strong picked them up and said, like, I mean, I will literally, my back hurts. I will bear the burden and pain of lifting you up so you can rejoice in jellyfish. And how much more Jesus Christ, who was strong, comes into this world and says, I will lift you up in love. And I will use my strength. I will be pushed down. I will hurt. I will die to lift you up. You know, not to see jellyfish, but to see the creator of the jellyfish. And to feel free from having to fight and struggle for control, because the one who has all power and control, you're sitting on his shoulders. He's humbled himself for you. He's gone to a cross for you to share this with you. This is our God. Can you pledge allegiance to him? And let go of all these other competing allegiances and power struggles in your own heart. Just to be like, I'm free to be lifted up to enjoy the jellyfish.